I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and irregular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an irregular warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 49 of Chasing Ghosts in Irregular Warfare podcast. The title of this particular episode is Storming America, TTP, to Make You Free. For those of you not aware, maybe you haven't been in the military, and of course, during this podcast, I tend to use acronyms and stuff, and I try to spell them out. TTP means tactics, techniques, and procedures, and like standing operating procedures, not standard, but standing operating procedures, that first word in SOP means that it is subject to revision at any time with new evidence and information to improve the efficacy of said procedures, is the methodology by which at the small unit level, which of course percolates up to the top in a rational and effective army, they start to improve the way they do their war business. Much as we've seen since the invasion by Russia of the Ukraine over 2 years ago. Can you believe it? Over 2 years ago. We have seen a renaissance of this 2002 to 2008 new variant Russian army that rose from the Soviet Red Army ashes. And it has been an extraordinary sight to behold. So let's take care of some housekeeping before we get to the podcast episode. If you wish to get in touch with me, and by the way, I want to extend my thanks and just heartfelt gratitude for those who correspond with me, those who follow me, and the small elite group of folk who support me with your dollars. You'll never find me with hat in hand, with the tip jar out. While I really appreciate my paid followers, you don't have to pay to listen to my podcast. But nonetheless, I appreciate the help, but you will never hear me out here, looking for funding and things like that. So with that, if you wish to get in touch with me, you can either go to my Substack, which you can find via Chasing Ghosts and Irregular Warfare podcast. You can find it with my RSS feeds. You can find contact information in the show notes, or you can contact me directly at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. Would love to hear from you. What have I been reading lately? I'm always asked that by readers and listeners. Well, what I've been reading lately is I just finished the third in a trilogy by Peter Caddick Adams, who appears to have been a serving officer in the British Army. Somebody recommended I read Sand and Steel, which was about the D-Day invasions and the liberation of France. I really loved his gathering of primary, secondary source documentation. Not to mention, he has that knack like Lieutenant Colonel Mike Snook, who wrote about Rorke's Drift and De Sonelwana in 1879. We actually walked the military terrain. And with a military officer's, or should I say, a soldier's perspective on what terrain does on a battlefield, lent that in the narrative that it gave us. So that trilogy starts with Sand and Steel, then it goes to Snow and Steel. I love the titles of his books, The Battle of the Bulge, and then Fire and Steel, the end of World War II in the West, which was very informative because he talks about what happened after the Battle of Bulge from January to April, May 1945 in the European Theater of Operations. Did I learn some things I didn't know? Of course I did. And what I find that in a comprehensivest fashion, the more I read from esteemed scholars who really tackle these things in a depth and breadth that I appreciate and I can't afford to do myself, I appreciate the kind of elucidation, illumination, and depth of perception increases I get on finding out just why these wars did what they did. I also read in preparation for a professional organizational event at which I spoke in June, I had revisited Brave Ship, Brave Men by Arnold S. Lott. I think this was written in early 60s, something like that. As a matter of fact, Admiral Nimitz retired Admiral Nimitz called it one of the most ripping yarns he had read. I'm paraphrasing there. One of the most ripping yarns he had read about what happened for 52 minutes on, I think it was May 3rd, 1945, the USS Ward, a DM, a minesweeper that had been reflagged as a picket ship in off of the coast of Okinawa to protect the landing forces and the ships from kamikaze and aerial attacks. So it had a very sophisticated and large complement of anti-aircraft weaponry on it. Well, the ship was just devastated. Absolutely devastated. Why do I find that so interesting? Because when I look at the future of warfare in the 21st century, as I've mentioned before, especially when I've discussed Nagorno-Karabakh, when I've discussed what's happening with UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, and of course we have unmanned ground vehicles coming into the fore, unmanned surface vehicles, unmanned subsurface vehicles, all these air-breathing modalities that are not manned, but they're either third-party intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance platforms that are lofted and loitering and providing the information needed for targeting, where sensors and effectors are married together. What I find increasingly interesting is we have to use models and simulations, if not anything, to find out what product or what effector or what sensor is going to work in war. Well, when you look at what happened in April, May, off the coast of Japan, Okinawa in particular, what you discover is that kamikazes sorta, kinda, emulate the behavior of terminal maneuvering of unmanned aerial vehicles we have today with the kamikaze modality of manned aerial vehicles that could terminally maneuver. Because terminal maneuvering against combustible munitions and such, not missiles, but AAA fire, anti-aircraft artillery, and that kind of thing, it's really tricky. As a matter of fact, if we hop in that hot tub time machine from 1945 and we go back to 1942 at the Battle of Midway, you find that while U.S. naval torpedo bombers, because they were so antiquated and badly equipped and badly trained, God bless all those men who died during that Midway campaign, who were in the U.S. Navy at the time, in these antiquated aerial vehicles shooting torpedoes that didn't work, because, of course, as everybody who was apprised of U.S. naval warfare in the Pacific, it wasn't until 1943, maybe the summer and fall, that the significant torpedo issues in the U.S. Navy were solved. As a matter of fact, it is my suggestion that if we were to take a counterfactual merry-go-round ride back then, the Pacific War and the Pacific Theater of Operations against the Japanese would have probably been 6 to 12 months shorter if we had effective torpedoes at the beginning of the Pacific conflict instead of 2 years into it. So with that, the point that I'm making is that when I look at modeling and sims, when I look at what do we have representative in history that sort of tells us, well, what happened then? What happened then that speaks to today? I still hold that when you look at manned kamikazes that have terminal maneuvering, all terminal maneuvering means is that they are not coming in on a straight parabola, but they may be shifting and jiving and mixing so that they are changing the attitude of what they were doing. In that hot tub time machine ride that I was talking about going to the Battle of Midway, is that when it came to our dive bombers, talk about balls of steel, when it came to the dive bombers, the dive bomber, of course, is a plane that has a 500, 1,000 kilogram bomb below. And if you've ever been to an air museum, I would urge you to take 10 minutes to examine very close the technology involved in how to do this. What happens is the aircraft flies towards the ship. It gains the significant altitude that it needs to drop in almost a straight line towards the deck using markers on the deck, such as the Japanese flag signal on the four carriers in Kido Butai in the Battle of Midway that were sunk at that time. When those planes are coming in, when there's slight maneuvering, no matter how wretched and thick that anti-aircraft artillery was that was being sent aloft almost vertically by the Japanese, they simply couldn't stop it. And let's suppose this too, and here's an important thing to consider. If they had taken it out, once that bomb is away, physics dictates that it's going to be very difficult for that AAA artillery to detonate that bomb in air, and it's going to land. It's going to land on the ship. So in the end, what I'm saying is that, again, history is our great mentor and our great teacher. And as I've told you again and again in this podcast, it is the least incompetent armies that win. It is the least incompetent armies and navies that prevail. So in this case, well, why don't we use this bloodless for us, bloodless practicum, looking back, and maybe use those kamikaze attacks, reproduce them in modeling in Sims now, and figure out, well, what are some of the ways that we can employ maybe matching AAA anti-aircraft artillery with missiles going aloft, with our SeaWiz and Phalanx assets, things like that? Is there some kind of mathematical formula we can come out with today in the 21st century that we may not have had then that would show us the perfect combination of doing that? So those are among the books that I've read of late. I've really enjoyed them. I also started again, and I read this very early on, was William Trotter's treatment of Frozen Hell, the Finnish account of the enormous David and Goliath triumphs of the Finnish against the Russians in 1940 in the Winter War. So that's what I've been reading of late. And now we're going to get on track with the episode. Thanks for indulging me in that preamble. What I want to talk about today is readers, listeners, and correspondents have reached out and they've said, okay, Bill, Storming America, four-part series, starting with episode 37. What you postulated was that what happened October 7th of last year in Israel out of Gaza, and we're not going to talk about the results afterwards. We're simply going to talk about that 24-hour attack. Could that be replicated here? And with the assistance of Kirk Schlichter and William Fortune, who I talked about because I can't take all the credit for either having written the books that led me to the mind zephyrs that I suffered afterwards and the ideas that I started to generate as far as what that would look like here in America, folks have said, well, Bill, you've described what could possibly happen. And by the way, I still submit and suggest to everybody listening within earshot is that it can happen tomorrow morning, to which I dedicate this episode. There's nothing I can do with policy in America. There's nothing I can do to influence the DOD to do better things. There's nothing I can do to make the DOD and the U.S. Navy listen, for instance, and say, look, stop building aircraft carriers. They are the crossbow and chariot of the 21st century. I'm Bill. I'm a small podcast. I simply don't have that kind of influence, nor do I get the invitations to the fancy and snooty salon parties at West Point or the military institutes or the salons of power in D.C. or the Pentagon and such. They're not going to tender any invitations for me to come and speak or chat with me. So that being the case, I'm going to consign myself to, well, what can I offer you out there as my individual listeners and readers who are interested in, well, what can I do as a person who has friends, families, neighbors who I can help and who I can find a way to prepare myself for this? Now, first and foremost, this is not a religious show, and as most people on this show know, I am a capitalist stoic. I am not an atheist. As a matter of fact, I'm finding myself sidling closer and closer to a religionist philosophy that I will keep consigned close to my vest now that I find in my waning years as my mortal coil beckons. Maybe I should take it into further consideration and spend a little more time with it. So that's up to you. Whatever one uses as a spiritual and religious sustenance to drive you through the failures and struggles of life, that is up to you. And that's for you to figure out, well, what are you going to do to use that as what you're going to put in your rucksack to prepare for what I have suggested, morbidly, I guess, could possibly happen tomorrow morning? Those who doubt that, you may do so. And here's the thing. I have prepper friends. I've been a prepper. I think I'm more of a mild prepper than I used to be in the past. But I do prepare because I think that husbands and fathers have a primary obligation to be the providers and protectors of their families and friends and extended families. And as men, we take that seriously because we are the civilizational protectors. And in the end, as civilizational protectors, we are expendable, women aren't. I don't mean that in a chauvinist sense. I mean that in a very logical 50,000-year DNA-wired imperative for myself where I could die. It would be a tragedy. Meh. For others, maybe it wouldn't be. Maybe there'd be celebrations. But who knows? I know that my children and my wife and close friends and blood family wouldn't enjoy that. But nonetheless, I could do that and will survive. If my wife or my children or my grandchildren, especially if any of my women folk, if that happens to them, civilization is in trouble. So I share with you this quick anecdote from my youth. I'm an 8-year-old. I'm wandering around my father. I am preternaturally inquisitive about everything going on around me. And I'm chatting with my father. I grew up in Miami, Florida. We're in Miami. And I'm wandering around and I look at things and I say, Dad, who built that car? Who built that building? Who built the elevator? Yes, I was that child. So my dad said, mend it. And I looked at him quizzically, my Spock eyebrows going up in an arch. And I said, but Dad, then what do women make? And he looked at me and he said, us. And I thought, wow, then it didn't strike me with the depth and importance it does now being in the autumn of my life, as it were, approaching winter, how important and how probably profound that is civilizationally for a millennia. I mean, that's why men do what they do and women do what they do. I mean, there's a tremendous complementarian relationship between men and women that allows us to establish these apogees of Western civilization that we have today. And yes, that is a bit of the neo-Victorian in me speaking. So I'm not going to trouble you in this episode with, hey, look, you've got to be in a bunker, you've got to be in a rural area, you've got to have your bug-out bags, although I will speak to that tangentially, you've got to have all of these things, you have to have a year of food or 12 years of food or whatever the case may be. There are plenty of folks with far more knowledge than me burning the internet up with all that information that you can find at your leisure. I mean, we are in a position right now as human beings in human civilization to actually have access to practically every scintilla of written correspondence, books, PDFs, anything that was committed to institutional memory in either books or electronically. We have access to all of that, which is why, to a certain extent, when folks say, well, what's going to, and yes, I do enjoy post-apocalyptic literature on occasion, but nonetheless, you have to ask yourself, okay, all of a sudden, civilization is destroyed. Could it be a coronal mass ejection solar event that through EMP dissolves all electronic circuits planet-wide or maybe in the United States? And then William Fortune, who I had referred to in episode 37 and the follow-on episodes in Storming America, had written one second after where he discusses what is going to be the results of that. And his projection at the time was, after a year, 90% die-off in North America. And I thought at first, well, nah, that doesn't sound right. And then as I read it and I read the congressional testimony on EMP and EMP effects and such, I thought to myself, maybe that is realistic. It could be a comet. It could be a dinosaur extinction event. It could be anything. But the one thing that we have that none of those other civilizations that fell have is we have what I just referenced, this tremendous baseline of knowledge from which we can rise from the ashes, and you don't have to reinvent the wheel because all the data, all the information is there. So if you're interested in that, there's plenty of other far smarter folks than me who will talk to you about that very thing on YouTube, on Rumble. By the way, use the Brave browser. Then you don't have to listen to any advertisements, as it were, which are very irritating for me when I'm checking out some YouTube channels that I enjoy. Now, what I've discovered is that in order to protect yourself from what happened in Israel on October 7th, 2023, will come down to several factors, and one of those factors will be weapons, and they will be weapons that you have on you or in your vehicle or at your home. So we're going to spend a little bit of time with that, and then we're going to talk about some other things, and then we'll probably call it a day and make this a shorter episode than most, but I felt that there was an imperative from my readers and listeners that they wanted me to address this, so I'm addressing it. Per weapons, I've been around weapons for a very long time, probably most of my adult life, and I have shot competitively, both rifle and pistol. I have trained rifle and pistol. I have a significant amount of experience. And one thing I want to give you in this as a proviso, I'm going to tell you what pistols and rifles I recommend. If you don't like my selections, so be it. The gods be with you. And if you are competent and effective with whatever you choose, this is sort of like, well, do you drive a Ford? Do you drive a Chevrolet? Do you drive a Toyota? Why don't you drive not only what's your preference, but works for your mission profile and your lifestyle? The same thing applies here. So I would rather not hear from anybody in correspondence who are going to tell me, well, Bill, you know, you're evidently very enchanted with the Stoner platform, the AR platform, and the Glock. Well, there's these other variants out there that are tremendous. For instance, I'll get AK guys coming out and Kalashnikov guys, and they'll say, man, you're really missing out. I mean, this is better than the Stoner platform. Now, look, I'm not telling you that the Kalashnikov, and by the way, we are going to get a little geeky here, so bear with me, but if you're a gun guy, you're going to enjoy it. So let's get into it. You fight your way to your rifle with your pistol, but we cannot carry rifles with us into the supermarket or whatever the case may be. By the way, your mileage may vary. Check the laws and wherever you live. I happen to live in the state of Florida where we have what's called constitutional carry, which means that I don't need to get a permit or license to carry discreetly. I don't like the word concealed because it's provocative. So I say discreet carry, which means that no one can see that I'm carrying. I carry what's referred to as appendix in the waistband, which is that if you look at my belt buckle and you look at a clock where noon is the belt buckle and then it's 1300 just to the right of the belt buckle, that's where I carry. And I carry using something called MDC. And what that is, it's simply a lanyard and a trigger cover over my Glock. And I have been carrying like this for probably going on 2 decades. I have been a Glock guy since 1991 when I purchased my first Glock 22. And since then, I have a Glock Armada. I have gone through a variety of Glocks. I've made a number of Glock mods. I have everything from a stone cold unmodified Glock 17 to what's referred to, and my gun buddies out there will know what this is, a Glock Roland Special, which is a tuned Glock that has a light, a red dot, and a compensator on it. Probably the most accurate pistol I've ever fired, although I will never be more accurate than any of my Glocks, and I pretty much use, I keep the OEM barrels, by the way, but I pretty much use S3F barrels or Blacklist or some other aftermarket barrels that have the thread on them. So potentially if I have to put a suppressor on it, I have that capability. But nonetheless, for me, it is the Glock platform. Now, like I said, a number of you out there know that there is a 1911 versus Glock war that's been going on for decades in the gun circuits and those who enjoy weapons, whether they shoot competitively, whether they use it for defense, whether they're just collectors, whatever the case may be. I repeat, if you are a 1911 aficionado, if you love SIG, whatever it is, the HK, whatever it is that you love, great. And if you can shoot it effectively, wonderful. But myself and my sons, we have gone to the Glock platform and stayed with it. Now, my eldest son still uses Glocks, but he's played a little bit with some other ones, but there it is. But nonetheless, all of my sons are competent. We make very few changes to the Glocks that we have. I tend to use, and here we're going to get a bit geeky and technical, so I apologize if you don't enjoy that. And I will put some of the stuff in the show notes, and I would appreciate responses or commentary from my listeners on what you think, or if you have any questions about delving a little more deeply into what modifications one would make to a clock. For myself and my family, we carry everywhere we go, everywhere we can, and those places that don't permit us to carry, well, let's just say that we will do what we think is proper to protect ourselves and our family. That being the case, I've explained to you how simple it is using my lanyard trigger guard for me to carry what's called MDC. I can't say out loud what MDC is on this program because it's G-rated. But nonetheless, if you correspond with me, I'll let you know what those letters stand for. But nonetheless, I use either that or I use an appendix inside the waistband carry holster that has what's called a sidecar, and the sidecar holds a magazine. So if you look up AIWB, the two that I really like are T-Rex Arms and Tier 1. I think they make the best AIWB holsters on the market. You'll have to play with them because, as with all gun guys and gun gals, we all have that box that we call the box of holsters of woe, because finding a holster that's good for you, you can see what it is, you can purchase it, but you have to bring it home, you have to test drive it, you have to test fire, you have to wear it, because as all of you AIWB wearers know, you don't want to drop anything on the floor when you're driving because you're not going to be able to reach for it because of the orientation of the holster right there at the front of your stomach. Now, by the way, there are options and there are ways for you to AIWB. It works for me, works for my family. Those of you who may be a little less trim in the waistline than I am, you may find some difficulties with it, but there are workarounds. As a matter of fact, AIWB means appendix inside the waistband carry, and I carry at 1300. Now, if we go on that clock and we go to 1800, what we find is that's on the right side of the waist. I'm right-handed, so that would be my strong hand. If you happen to be left-handed, that would be your strong hand. And unfortunately, the shooting world is built around strong hands being right-handed. So if you happen to be left-handed, you will want an inside the waistband or outside the waistband holster that you can carry that fits what you need, but it's going to be positioned in a way that you find to be that works for you. And it's all a matter of tailoring to your mission profile, the fit of your body, and just what your risk assessments and assumptions are. For me, my risk assumption is that I would rather have what I need, even in higher risk circumstances, to protect myself than to be left naked and unable to defend myself. So you can read from that what you wish. There's all kinds of holster options out there. So I just mentioned AIWB. Now I'll mention outside the waistband. Having spent 2 years in Afghanistan and also carried weapons as a combat tourist around the world in other environs and carrying a pistol, what I found is I love G-code. G-code has this thing called RTI, which is a retainer interface that allows me to wear what I call my Iron Man circle of strength, and I lock the holster onto that. So if I'm getting into a vehicle and I happen to be carrying on my hip, on my body armor and my plate carrier, I would also have an RTI pad on there so I could simply unlock it, take it off there, and then click it right onto my body armor. I will put this in the show notes so that you guys can examine that as you wish. Why the Glock? Because it works. Is it ugly? No, it's not ugly to me because for me, I'm a cruiser head. I find the Land Cruiser to be one of the most beautiful engineering marvels in the world when it comes to automobiles. Form follows function. There's a certain beauty to these rugged simplicity and effectiveness. As a matter of fact, I devoted a podcast episode to Toyotas and technicals and why they have ruled the irregular warfare world for so long in the 20th century, even into the 21st century. So for me, the Glock works. What Glock mods do I make? We Red Dot everything. The Red Dot has changed my life. If you haven't gone to Red Dot, you're really missing out. It simply makes you faster, simply makes you more effective. My sons and I, especially my youngest son and I, are really fond of red dots. He spends considerably more time dry firing and practicing than I do. I need to devote myself to spending more time to do that very thing, because dry fire is the key and the answer to making yourself more effective with all your weapons. And we'll go into that in a little more detail for the rifle later on. What Glock mods do I make? My God, the number of Glock mods you can make. And by the way, fill in the blank with 1911, SIG, HK, whatever your preferred pistol platform is, the amount of aftermarket items available for you to upgrade that and make it more effective. And of course, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't make it more effective and just drains your pocket. But nonetheless, the minimum mods I would make is, do you have a 3.5-pound trigger? If you don't, get the Glock OEM or the Ghost OEM 3.5-pound trigger. Put that in there. I told you about the aftermarket barrels. Very helpful. As far as optics are concerned, I used to use Trigicon exclusively. Now I'm, for the most part, Holosun. I prefer the custom cuts on the slides themselves because it has a lower by tenths of an inch inset into the gun that the MOS, the modified optics modalities that come with a Glock, where you can park it on there. But with this, it's actually drilled into the slide itself. I prefer that, but your mileage may vary. So I use a red dot, and then I always put a kind of, Vickers makes these wings that you can put on the back so that if you have to, you can use your thumbs instead of simply your grip strength to ride that slide back and forward to get it into battery. As far as magazines, lots of Magpul. I've got lots of Magpul for both rifle and pistol. I find that the right thing to do, and I learned this from an old salt when I was in the Legions, is that you store your ammunition in magazines. I have a considerable amount of ammunition. Most of it is stored in magazines. I would urge you to do the same with both rifle and pistol. So I think that pretty much does. Now, whatever you want to do with your Glock, that's up to you. You can put tape on it. You can put exquisite lights on it, like a Streamlight or a Surefire. You can do all kinds of things. Like the Stoner platform, it's very Lego-centric. I mean, you could do almost anything that you want, but for me, those are the bare-bones mods that I would make for what is already an extraordinary pistol platform for $500 to $600, and everybody complains, well, it comes with these shitty plastic sights. Well, of course it does, because you know you're going to change them out. So if you change them out to what you want, why don't they spend more than $10 on a set of shitty plastic sights? Because they know you're going to change it out. But it also keeps the price point down. You can get yourself into a very high-performing Glock with an aftermarket barrel, the Glock itself, and a red dot for about $1,200, $1,300 with mods. So, and I highly recommend that you do all kinds of dry fire practice. Dry fire is the answer to really achieving the kind of excellence in fire that you want to under time, which is going to be accuracy and quick. I am quick. I'm not as quick as my youngest son, who is he's just an excellent shooter. I remember, I don't think he'll be embarrassed if I tell him this story. My youngest son is in Uncle Sam's Misguided Children. He's in there for 4 years. He got out, thank goodness. Well, he's at the range one day, and he's shooting, and his rifle reloads and his pistol reloads, but in this case, his rifle reloads are extraordinary. He will drop a magazine from his rifle, and he's got the new magazine in there, and it's loaded and locked before the other one hits the deck. So he's doing this, and he's firing very accurately, very quickly. So a small killer whale pod of gray and crusty senior USMC NCOs and gunnies comes over, and one of them looks at my son and he says, "Bubert, where'd you learn to fire a gun like that? You're like, fill in the blank, John Wick." He looks at him and he says, "Gunny, I was raised as a child soldier." A man couldn't be more proud of his son after he related that story to me. He's an extraordinary shot, and he went to Appleseed with me consistently when I was a shoot boss and an Appleseed instructor for years. He would assiduously attend those events with me. He's just he's a natural man of the gun, as are all my sons. But he's the most dedicated man of the gun. Dry fire is king. Dry fire is how you can do this well. Speaking of which, and Mantis X doesn't pay me for this, but Mantis X provides dry fire tools for both pistol and rifle. I have both. I can't emphasize enough how much it takes your dry fire game to the next level and just makes you that much more lethal so that you can attain those born and wick-like capabilities that all of us desire. So for me, it's the Glock. I carry JHP rounds. I tend to use 124 grain. There are 115 and 147 grain. The sweet spot for me and my sons has been 124 grain. It's what we consistently shoot in practice, and we consistently shoot Full Metal Jacket in practice. On occasion, we'll shoot our JHPs, our jacketed hollow points. But when conducting social work and carrying discreetly, we are equipped with JHP rounds in the magazine. Normally, I'll carry one or two additional magazines, but I do keep a ready bag with anywhere from 15 to 18 magazines in it, in the car, if I'm traveling, whatever the case may be for pistol, along with a variety of other things such as cleaning instruments and all the things that I would need, maybe additional equipment, tools, things like that, so that if I'm on the road or I happen not to be home yet and I need to conduct some kind of field or depot level repairs on my weapon, I can do it because I've got all the equipment with me. So that satisfies my need for a pistol. And I have a pistol, by the way. I'm in my home now. I have one on me. I'll have one within easy reach. When I sleep, I have one near me. Same thing for a rifle. But, of course, when I'm out and about, I don't always carry a rifle on my person because that would cause a number of people, most likely government supremacists, to fill their pants in alarm and head for their fainting couches because a man is carrying a rifle in public. So that's why I carry discreetly. It's why I carry a pistol, and no one knows any better. So that satisfies the pistol requirement. For those of you, there are three gun matches out there, which is pistol, shotgun, and rifle. For those of you who are enamored and ensconced with shotguns, I'm not going to discuss that because I personally don't like the shotgun as a defense instrument. If I thought that loading one round at a time, and I know there are magazine-fed shotguns, but if I thought that loading one magazine, one round at a time was an efficacious way to defend myself, why wouldn't I have a Krag Jorgensen? Or why wouldn't I have a 1903 30-06 that was issued to the U.S. Armed Forces that even had a delimiter in it that wouldn't allow me to put more than one round in it? I'm not going to limit myself to that, and I don't find that it is more efficacious to have a shotgun than a rifle. In my home, a pistol is my first line of defense, but the rifle's not far away. So let's discuss rifles. As I discussed earlier, I'm going to have people who are going to write in, and they're going to say, well, Bill, you know, I love my Krag Jorgensen. Well, Bill, I love my Garand. By the way, I love my Garand too, but it isn't my primary go-to. If you don't own an M1 Garand, you're the poorer for it. It's a terrific shooting rifle, but it's not the one that I'm going to go to war with. And I don't want to go to war, by the way, but I am going to be equipped to defend my friends and family because that's what I'm built for. But nonetheless, for a rifle, it's the Stoner platform for the Buford family. What we've discovered is that in 1956, Eugene Stoner comes up with this absolutely brilliant, almost science fiction-like idea for modern weaponry. And this is merely 11 years after the conclusion of World War II. And, of course, there were influences from World War II, like the Sturmgewehr and a lot of the German technology that went into semi-automatic and automatic firearms that influenced the choices that he made. So for us, I know that it got a bad rap in Vietnam because of unchromed barrels and a variety of teething problems that it had as a new design. But I've got to tell you, from the 1980s to the 90s, and especially rocketing forward into the 21st century, the Stoner platform is, as paraphrasing Schwarzenegger from Terminator, Until the 40-watt plasma rifle comes out, the Stoner is the rifle for me. Like I mentioned, I am an admirer of the Kalashnikov. As a matter of fact, if I could and I had to wield a Kalashnikov, I would use the Finnish Valmet or I would use the Israeli Galil. I happen to think that when it comes to form and pattern of the Kalashnikov design, that is the peak, that is the apogee, that is the form and function of perfection of the Kalashnikov, and those are the ones I would go to. I choose not to. As a matter of fact, just up to the eve of the 21st century, our battery for the family was, believe it or not, FNFALs, because I thought that the 308 FNFAL, those of you not familiar with it, look it up. In French, that is the Fusil Automatique Légère, and the FNFAL was designed in 1953 by Duodon Saif, manufactured by FN Herstal. Not only did I own a heavy barrel at one time, but I built seven of them so that I could be equipped and my family could be equipped, because when my children left the house, they left the house with a Glock and a long arm. Well, 21st century comes in. I'm not convinced that the AR-10 308 Knights armament variants have reached the maturity to exceed that of the FNFAL's capability. But then I discover 5 to 10 years into the new century that it's time to upgrade the family armory from the FNFAL to the AR-10, and then later to the M16, M4, AR-15 variants in 5.56, which, while my oldest son still has his FNFAL, my younger sons don't. They do have AR-10s, which is the 308, but they all have M4, M16, AR-15 variants, which is the 5.56. So for our family and friends, by the way, and by extension, shout out to Skip, who is our village armorer, who has been a tremendous influence on my selections of firearms that I would use to effectively defend friends and family. So we sort of gave up on the FNFAL. I still admire the weapon as I admire the M1 Garand. It is not the 21st century weapon of choice. For rifle, we have settled on the AR-15, I think for a variety of reasons. It is just a tremendous weapon system in so many ways. It does something interesting called direct impingement, which means that it shits where it eats, which means that the gas, which is why you have to clean them, which is the gas that comes out once the rounds are reloaded from the magazine after the expended one leaves the rifle itself, leaves gas residue in it, hence direct impingement instead of a gas system. And I'm not going to burden you with technical problems with the gas piston-operated FNFALs. I refer you to a two-part article in Small Arms Review where they interviewed Mr. Knight about why the gas piston system is not effective for the Stoner platform for a variety of reasons. Most of that reasoning and engineering knowledge is in the second part of the interview. I would urge you to read both parts. I'll make sure to put that in the show notes. So what do I have? You have three tiers of AR-15s. You got the cheapies, which I don't recommend. You've got the mid-tier and you've got the top tier. For me, and I'm not paid by anybody for any of these endorsements or accolades that I shower on these particular manufacturers that I recommend. I don't get free shit from them or anything like that. But what I've discovered is that when it comes to the Stoner platform, that bulk carrier group that's in it, and I'm not going to burden my listeners who don't know what that is, please look it up. That bulk carrier group is the raison d'etre of why it works so well, and it is the one component in the weapon, besides having a straight and true barrel, that allows it to function as exquisitely as it does. Bravo Company, BCM, all of my weapons have those BCGs. I think that you cannot go wrong. If you're looking for a top-tier AR, like a Noveski, or like a Voltor, or a Daniel Defense, or the other spendy ones, or the HK 416 variants and such, that's top dollar. You can spend the money. And by the way, if you spend the money on that, great. You know, you're going to walk away with something that, if you treat it properly, you'll give it to your children and grandchildren. Your children will give it to their children. So if you want to spend on mid and top tier products in the AR world, you can't go wrong with them. I recommend not spending on low tier products or some real junk out there at the lower end. I do find it miraculous that if you need to put together a $600 AR, you can. I think in the neighborhood of $1,000 to $1,500 will get you the AR rifle that you want. And again, there's going to be folks out there who's going to say, well, I use the HK-91 or the HK-93, or I use the Kalashnikov, or I happen to use an M1 Garand and I love it, or I use a Beretta BM-59, which is probably the most capable magazine-fed M1 Garand variant that was ever made. Certainly not the M1A, which I am not a fan on for a variety of reasons. If you wish to know those reasons, I won't bore you here, but correspondents can write me and I'll give you an encyclopedic response to why I think the M1A and the M14 is so loathsome. And by the way, when I was on a Navy rifle pistol team in the Pacific Regionals, we had match-grade M14s that we used in rifle competition. So I have considerable experience using those weapons, but I would not choose to purchase one for a variety of reasons. What are some of the mods that you're going to make? Well, I'm a Magpul fanboy. I tend to like a very vertical pistol grip. I tend to like the UBR stock, which is a little heavy. I use Magpul mags almost exclusively, with the exception of some others. I don't have any metal mags. I take very good care of my followers. I make sure that whatever sling I use, I happen to use the Magpul MS4, that the same sling is on all my weapon systems, so that whatever I pick up in the dark, I know exactly how it's configured. When it comes to irons, I use everything from Diamond Head to, which probably they have the most exquisite folding irons out there. Magpul makes a great set of both plastic and metal iron. Of course, Knights Armament probably makes among the best. As far as the furniture, for me, it's going to be Magpul. I'm very fond of FTE. I'm very fond of bipods for my AR-10, but not for my AR-15s. I told you what kind of slings I use. I do have friends like Skip who uses Vickers and swears by them, and even my youngest son really likes a Vickers sling. So you got to find out what's going to work for you. Just because I make all of these suggestions on what you should buy, what I'm telling you is what works for me. And what you'll find, the very best thing you can do if you're brand new to guns is test drive friends' guns or test drive guns that are offered at the range that you go to and figure out before you purchase what system's going to work for you. But what you will discover with both pistol or rifle is that as your knowledge increases, your fitment increases, your fit for purpose attitude increases, whatever your mission profile changes are, you're going to find things that are going to be outside the realm of the recommendations that I make, and you'll make your own process improvements on your own. So we've covered the Magpul furniture, Magpul mags, and what I've settled on too for red dots, and yes, I do red dot and scope all of my rifles. There's two variants of optics that I use. And by the way, let me put in this plug. Spend the very most amount of money you possibly can on optics. Spend the very most amount of money that you can on the optics marriage to the gun, meaning you want to have a monolithic instead of two scope rings. You want to have a monolithic Picatinny modality that bolts onto your rifle that has the scope married into it. There is an art and science to mounting scopes that you will discover through many hours of frustration. I happen for LPVOs, which are low-power variable optics. I really enjoy Vortex. I think they've got a terrific warranty. I think they've got terrific glass. Vortex razors. The glass happens to be Japanese, which is some of the best glass in the world. Isn't it curious that some of the best glass in the world comes from former Axis partners in the war to save Joseph Stalin? But nonetheless, For LPVOs, low power variable optics, for me, I use a Vortex Razor. It's either a 6 or a 10. And then for red dots, I found that the Holosun red dots are as good as the Aimpoint red dots, and you'll find what fits for you, but spend the most amount of money that you possibly can. And again, I mentioned Mantis X training systems for dry fire with pistol. They make a Blackbeard system that I find tremendous, and it does something that will just knock your socks off for those of you who have been around the Stoner platform for a while and have a frustration with the charging handle that is on an AR. What happens with the charging handle is one must take your cheek off the stock from your cheek weld in order to advance the next round. If you're just putting a new round in, when you pull back on that charging handle, however you do that. And by the way, make sure your charging handles, like Radian, make some big ones. Make sure they are oversized and not the OEM standard size that comes on M4s. You will thank me later. What the Mantis Blackbeard does is it automatically cycles it when you are doing dry fire, so you don't have to take your cheek off and do whatever it takes to pull that charging handle back and forward to go on to the next trigger press. So those are the rifles and pistols that I recommend. Your mileage may vary. Now we go on to all the money you're going to spend on tools, on torque wrenches, on bits, on rifle rests, all the rest. If you're new to this, you will discover you're going to spend a lot more money than you did initially for the firearm itself, to include all the ammunition you need to feed it. And then you're also going to discover, if you've been around the block for a while, all of you guys know and gals know exactly what I'm talking about, where not only will you have holster boxes of woe, but you're going to find that, well, that BCG didn't work. Well, that flash hider didn't work. And now with suppressors becoming the next big thing, that's going to be something for everybody out there in the audience who is considering either getting a rifle or has one already. Suppressors. So look into that. I think it's become a whole lot easier to get them as far as time is concerned, certainly not easier because of ATF paperwork. So dry fire training is so essential for you to get good at this craft. But I so recommend going to formal training and putting the money out, getting ready for it, and taking formal training from people who know what they're about. The training that we go with is from Keller at Gamut Resolutions. He happens to live here in Florida, but when I was in Arizona, we contracted with him, along with a number of my friends, to give us a private weekend course in advanced rifle and pistol. It is worth every penny that you put into the training to do that, and what you've got to do when you approach the training, even as an intermediate or advanced shooter, it's always a diagnostic to unscrew yourself from bad habits or things that you're doing that can be improved by having somebody else watch what you're up to and offering, in Bob Keller's case, the decades of expertise that he has to help you diagnostically unscrew what you're doing wrong to do things right. Okay, so for new shooters, there's a lot of money ahead of you if you take this seriously and do this. For intermediate and advanced shooters, maybe I've told you things, maybe I've told you everything you already know, but nonetheless, you can riff off of some of what I've said. But I look forward to correspondence if you have disagreements. So we've covered all of that. Now, ammunition. It's critical to have a lot of ammunition. And my friend John at, and I'll link this in the show notes, Back and Beyond, on August 2nd, 2024, just recently, as a matter of fact, he was part of the inspiration for this very podcast. He did a post called Ammo Inventory Management. I'm going to read from some of it because it's so extraordinary. He quotes Chuck Pressburg, who says, "Amateurs talk about gear, professionals talk shot placement, masters are too busy dry firing. Truth be that." So he says, and I quote, "The prepper tubes are ablaze with videos and discussions on deep, hard answer important questions like, how many mags should I carry? What's the best shit hits the fan rifle?" and similar stupidity. Basic mission planning and threat analysis answers this quick. What he's saying is that that should not constitute the variety, or don't be so gear-centric and money-centric that you neglect the training necessary so that whatever exquisite tools you've purchased aren't used in their most effective manner because you're more of a Geardo, even though I'm an admitted Geardo, who doesn't practice with his kit. Which is why he says, quote, I'm a diehard advocate for dry fire. Even with unlimited ammo, many skills are still better worked dry. Assuming we hold to the philosophy of dry fire 3 to 5 times a week in short but frequent sessions, we must also regularly confirm our efforts live fire at the range with live ammo. And he says, I'd suggest the average shooter with a good baseline skill can probably maintain their skill levels for the most part with 200 to 300 rounds per month. But we can stipulate that. You may not build massive skill, but I believe you can maintain what you have with those numbers of regular dry fire. Again, your mileage may vary. Now, if you're a competitive shooter, you're going to shoot more. If you're a tactical shooter who is preparing for whatever it is the mission profile is that you envision for your friends and family, that's going to determine what your ammunition throughput's going to be. But he goes on to say something that I think is really interesting and important. He says this, I've written previously about this, but in this installment, I want to look further at the concept of what I've always called the ammo savings account and the checking account. I do this with most consumables. First, the prep patriots need to overcome the idea of looking at ammo as solely something you store. Look at it as store inventory. I repeat, look at it as store inventory. Yes, ammo needs to be stored for many reasons, but it's also a consumable. Many guys amass some ammo, then think they can cross it off the list. In reality, we really need a revolving door strategy. With our finances, we look at things like savings to get us through hard times or to amass wealth. Essentially, it is delayed spending power. Benchmarks like the 3 to 6 months, up to 12 months emergency funds, etc. Serious practitioners of the craft of arms need to be looking at applying these concepts to their ammo storage. Develop a metric for your storage. This is your savings account ammo, only to be touched in emergency. If you borrow from it, pay back with extreme urgency. There are a myriad of metrics like rounds per gun owned or whatever the survival author du jour says. That's all well and good for me. He says, that's all well and good, but for me, I tend to look at my training pace as a metric. I'd like whatever I'm shooting per month to be sitting there in a one-year supply as a baseline. More is obviously better. He'd suggest for actual shooters, look at the ammo you train with for the most to stockpile. You don't want to end up with 20,000 rounds of green tip that you don't even use at your range because it damages the steel, or the same in gold dots for a pistol. You won't want to waste on a training day. And he goes on to say, if we shoot 300 rounds per week, we know after we shoot it up, it needs to be replaced. My common practice is to have 2,000 to 3,000 rounds of pistol in my checking account. I treat it like a normal checking account. I consider 1K to be my minimum balance. I essentially treat 1K to be zero. Never go below it. And obviously, case prices are going to be preferred. I'm going to put this article in the show notes. I think he brings up some really critical, good ideas in here that I can't emphasize enough are a great way to look at how you're doing your shooting business and how you're conducting yourself as far as getting prepared to effectively protect friends and family. So we've covered the tools that one may need kinetically. We've covered all of the associated accoutrements and equipment that you're going to need to maintain those, to include ammunition, to include you need to seek out training, to include you need to dry fire, and all of these things. Now we come to something else. Of late, I entered my 7th century on planet Earth. And I'm not fat, but I'm not as fit as I used to be. So about 3 weeks ago, I picked up a treadmill. Now I am assiduously trying to get back on that treadmill and trying to amp it up to 15, 20 miles a week every morning when I get up to get my cardio game better. I do isometric exercises. Maybe I should start ruck marching again. Pay attention to your physical fitness. Remember at the very beginning of this, and the very title of this episode is Storming America, TTP to be free. What this is about is that let's suppose that eventuality, that morbid eventuality of a Gaza invasion times 1,000 emerging tomorrow morning in America, as awful as that is. All I'm trying to do in this particular episode is give you some of the means, plans, and thinking that goes into being prepared if this happens to go off when you are out and about, or you're at work, or you're with your family, or whatever the case may be. Because it's real now. I don't, when I look at what's been happening in the UK the past few weeks, I think to myself, they're disarmed, and in the end, they are doomed because they can't defend themselves against sticks and stones and knives and machetes with a government that consistently and hoplophobically tries to disarm every aspect beyond unarmed combat to protect one's friends and family. I think that's awful. I think here we are in America, especially if you're in the free states in America that don't try to disarm you on an active daily basis. You do have all these tools available, but all these tools are part of a holistic suite. That holistic suite is going to be your mental fitness, your physical fitness, your awareness and situational understanding of what's going on around you at all times during your waking hours, your ability to have the tools at hand and the ability to have trained with the tools at hand to get out of bad situations. I remember when old Remus, rest in peace, he died several years ago, had a great blog, really enjoyed it. And he had this intuitively obvious statement where he said, stay away from crowds. I urge everybody that if you find there's a protest or a crowd or something like that, go the other way. Whatever's going on, go the other way. Take the long route. Whatever has to happen. In America today, especially if you live in the city, whatever you are doing, no matter how banal or minor you think it may be, you are filling up at the gas station. You are in a store, whatever the case may be, have your head on a swivel, have situational awareness, have situational understanding. When you go to eat in a restaurant, make sure that you have your back to a wall, make sure that you have all doors accounted for, make sure that you remain aware of what's going on around you. Jeff Cooper had his color code charts, conditioned red and black are conflict conditions. In those conflict conditions, you will find that physically, despite all the DNA wiring we men and to a lesser extent women have, that when you're in condition red and black, your finer motor reflexes start to retard themselves. You start to get a kind of tunnel vision. You start to get a kind of memory press that makes time seem to move faster. If I haven't mentioned it, I should have mentioned it. You need to have a timer that you've probably seen used in gun videos and such, which will help you increase your speed in drills that you conduct. All kinds of drills out there to do. The drills for our family that we primarily concentrate on, again, thanks Bob Keller at Gamut Resolutions, is primarily 3-inch dots. There's all kinds of fancy targets out there. You can spend a lot of money on targets, and I have in the past. But I buy 500 sheet packs of targets that just have an array of 3-inch dots on them. Because it's the whole Patriot thing of aim small, miss small. If you acclimatize and acquaint yourself in all of your training with having to get all your rounds in a 3-inch dot, it means that that 8-inch pie plate of the center of mass chest area that one would have to put rounds into to stop a threat, it becomes that much easier to do it with repetition, time, and dry fire. So what other things should you do? Well, of course, there's plate carriers. Of course, there's helmets and night vision. Have I mentioned night vision and the extraordinary advantages one can have with a set of PVS-14s, which are spendy? You're probably going to spend $4,000 for the PVS-14 along with the Wilcox mount and the J-arm. There's no doubt, but there's an old adage in the legions in which we said, if you have a $10 head, you need a $10 helmet. There are lots of books and things like that. I'm going to try to populate the show notes with some of my recommendations. But please take the time to make your own assessment. What I've tried to do and what has essentially become part 5 of the Storming America series is I've tried to really personalize this. I've tried to really bring this home. And I want you all to ask yourselves and gather your friends and family around you and ask yourselves, what do we need to protect ourselves? What do we need if we find ourselves in extremis or in a really bad situation in which we quite literally have to fight for our lives out of a bad place that we find ourselves? Are we prepared to do so? Now, I could spend hours talking about the different equipment, different go bags, bug out bags, emergency bags, all those kind of things, and in addition to prep foods and gen sets and all that. That is not the purview nor within the scope of this podcast series. And like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, there are plenty of more worthy and smarter people in that realm than me that you can find in the verse and in the YouTube channels and things like that. I mean, I'm all kinds of stuff that you can find. I'm a big fan of Grand Thumb, so highly recommend his videos. So take the time, take a look, but remember, in the end, only you are responsible for you, because no one has your best interests in mind, especially when it comes from a protection perspective, than you. So I would be interested in hearing your comments, questions, rebuttals. It is cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. I also have a Substack page that you can find that you will find in the show notes, in which we have comments and commentary available on that Substack page for my podcast episodes. Also, please shout out to recommend this podcast to anybody you think would be interested. And also, if you can post reviews on whatever podcast vendor that you have, if you enjoy this, please do so. I'd appreciate the solicitude. And with that, this is Bill out.